There have been three major U.S. pipeline spills just within this last month, and that is just a small part of the 220 significant incidents reported so far for 2016, and there have been 3,032 pipeline accidents since 2006. That provides a stark reminder of the environmental hazards of an aging pipeline infrastructure carrying fossil fuels. The cost of these leaks since 2006 has amounted to $4.7 billion. In Oklahoma, on October 24th of this year, the 30-inch S1 pipeline carrying crude oil from the critical Cushing, Oklahoma hub to refineries and chemical plants on the Gulf Coast began to leak and was shut down overnight. It was the second release connected with the Cushing storage facility in less than a month. In Pennsylvania, on October 21st, 55,000 gallons of gasoline gushed from a ruptured Sunoco logistics pipeline in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, just upstream from the Susquehanna River, and Carol Perenzon, who is a Susquehanna riverkeeper, said that witnesses who contacted her office reported that the smell of petroleum is so thick you can taste it. The 80-year-old pipeline was damaged by a heavy storm that dumped 7 inches of rain on the area.
Just excuse me, I want you to continue, but I'm baffled because I never hear very much about this stuff. Only the big major catastrophes where there's loss of life or things break out into flames. I saw that on Democracy Now. But routinely, I never hear about this stuff. Would you continue, please?
And I think a large part of that, just the, you know, the absence of coverage is due to the enormous clout that the extractive industry, like particularly oil and gas companies, have through like media coverage and just kind of this like intersecting web of like financial interests that how this infrastructure like manifests in our communications with each other. It's and also a lot of these accidents happen in like disenfranchised places too, so that's another reason there isn't very much coverage. In Alabama last month, the Colonial Pipeline leaked an estimated 336,000 gallons of gasoline and triggered concerns about gas shortages for drivers in the east. That spill was Colonial's fifth in the state this year and occurred on a 43-year-old section of the pipeline. Based on data from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, an arm of the U.S. Department of Transportation, the number of significant pipeline incidents grew 26.8% from 2006 to 2015. A significant incident is defined as one that results in serious injury or fatality, costs more than $50,000, releases more than 5 barrels of volatile fluids such as gasoline or 50 barrels of other liquids, or results in a fire or explosion. In 2015, there were 326 such incidents. That's comes out to one per day. Some 55% of the U.S. network of 135,000 miles of pipeline is more than 45 years old. Technology designed to detect pipeline leaks is highly unreliable, even though companies like Colonial Pipeline tout their use as a way to ensure safe operations. But a recent Reuters report found that these technologies are about as successful as a random member of the public finding a leak. Of 466 incidents studied by Reuters, only 22%, or 105, were detected by advanced detection systems. The others were found in different ways, with the public finding 99% of the leaks. In testimony before a House subcommittee earlier this year, Carl Wiemer, executive director of the watchdog group Pipeline Safety Trust, said, under the current statutes, there is no requirement that a pipeline company obtain any permit or permission to operate a pipeline in this country. Wiemer called on Congress to require PHMSA to issue permits for interstate transition pipelines and ensure that the company follow all rules and regulations.
I'm not only baffled, I'm just awestruck. I God damn. Now remember, our listeners out there, where did you hear this information? This is Slavey Boat Radio on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 on your dial. And if you want to check us out on the web, we live streaming on the web as I speak right now. I'm baffled. Sometimes you know there's things you're ignorant of, and but I tell you guys, I watch at least 2 different news broadcasts every day, at least 2, and I try to, I watch PBS, I watch Democracy Now. I'll also try to watch whatever they're offering on Channel 7 or 5. I watch a lot of news. I really do. I look at the New York Times, check all the headlines every day. That's just the way I came up, This head-fixing industry, this is why socialists and conscious workers, class-conscious people, refer to the capitalist news media system as the head-fixing industry. What you don't know will hurt you. And I'm kind of embarrassed here. Just being honest with the scope of this problem. Over 200 oil spills from pipelines, and they're building these pipelines just crazy. It's just crazy. But look, I want to share something with you now about these pipelines. We'll be back with Senti in a minute. But I just want you to know that there really is a problem in terms of, our president's pathetic attitude towards the treatment of the very people that are resisting the Black Snake, or this North Dakota pipeline. This is a quote from the President of the United States. And he said, "We're monitoring this closely. And I think, as a general rule, my view is that there is a way for us to accommodate sacred lands of Native Americans. And I think that right now, the Army Corps of it is examining whether there are ways to reroute the pipeline in a way. So we're going to let it play out for several more weeks and determine whether or not this can be resolved in a way that I think is properly attentive to the traditions of the first Americans." President Obama recently said this on the news. Isn't that just heart-rending? It makes me sick to my stomach. Let's be really clear. Properly attentive? Now, thanks to the work of, I would say, Democracy Now!, let's give her some credit, Amy Goodman, took film, went to these demonstrations and took film what was really going on. So let's be careful and let's see what has actually occurred. Have the First Amendment rights of the Native Americans who are leading up this struggle, have they been respected? Well, let's look. There has been unlicensed, apparently untrained, private security forces using dogs to bloody peaceful protesters. And these protesters, as Senti correctly pointed out earlier, refer to themselves as water protectors. We all need water. State officials arresting and overcharging journalists for covering the events, for simply being there. Amy Goodman herself was charged falsely. She came and showed up in court. They tried to charge her, to change the charge to rioting, and then a judge threw the damn thing out. A judge just said, no, this is so silly, I can't even allow this in the courtroom. A local sheriff is inflaming public opinion with false reports of pipe bombs, when what he actually heard was talk of the peace pipe. All right, so let me just tell y'all what the peace pipe is. I know maybe many of our younger people may not know what that is. Well, the peace pipe is the same thing you do on Friday night, okay? The peace pipe is, what do they call that, peyote? Well, Sandy don't want to, there used to be something called peyote, and that is one of the things that the Indians would put in that peace pipe and get mellow. In other words, they get right tonight. In other words, they get high. That's the peace pipe. Peace, peace. Sit down, relax, chill. That's the peace pipe. Not a pipe bomb, the sick son of a... Law officers were shooting and have been filmed shooting nonviolent water protectors in the back and front with rubber bullets. Now, let's be really clear about this. I used to be a member of a group called Cop Watch for over 20 years. And part of my duties was to study how exactly these so-called non-lethal weapons were supposed to be used. So I had to read the manuals, you know, and see. Well, actually, it is against the law to directly shoot a citizen with a rubber bullet. You're supposed to shoot them at the ground, and what they're supposed to do for crowd control is they're supposed to ricochet off of the ground, and if they strike a citizen, they're supposed to strike them below the waist. Actually, people have been killed by rubber bullets because they're used by law enforcement incorrectly, intentionally. We don't want no rubber bullets. Me no want none of them. Okay? Now, state officials housing arrestees in dog cages and conditions that violate international law against torturing prisoners. Mr. Obama. Oh, my goodness. We gonna monitor that? Or stop it? This is the President of the United States, right? We do not accept this type of treatment of human beings. Dog cages. Law enforcement on the riverbank using mace and pepper spray against nonviolent water protectors standing in the water. Official surveillance helicopters flying low to panic horses. They do this intentionally. Someone could... They actually shot a horse. I don't know if you know this. They shot a horse because the Native American water protectors were using the horses to kind of guide the buffaloes, and they had the buffaloes stampeding towards the police. Police shot one of the horses, killed him. Okay. Official surveillance helicopters mysteriously going off duty. And just before, quote, persons unknown, unquote, start a prairie fire with such ineptitude that the wind blows it away from the Standing Rock Sioux gathering ground. So these helicopter people get out the helicopter, start fires, and of course, who do you think they want to blame it on? And this is also, I think, something we need to take note of, and that is the apparent contempt of court by Energy Transfer Partners, who sent in bulldozers to destroy a burial ground that, once destroyed, could no longer be a reason for a federal court to rule against the pipeline. Desecration is not a criminal act, apparently, when you have a government permit for it, even when that permit is under litigation. Mr. Obama, Democrats make me want to vomit. You make me want to hack. We're tired of your sellout sorry ass trying to stab us in the back. We know what's going on, sir. You fool no one on this issue.
Okay, and you are listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio. This is
104.1.
All right.
On your FM dial.
On your FM dial. There is, on the note of Standing Rock, women, indigenous women who are part of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation have had a front and center role with leadership and decision making. So I would like to go into that while we are on this note. Women are leading the way at Standing Rock to protect the waters of North Dakota and bringing forth a global indigenous spiritual and ecological movement which honors the integral health and respect of the earth and people. A group of Lakota Sioux women from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, including LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, established the Sacred Stones Camp in April by the Cannonball River in North Dakota to protest the building of the Dakota Access Pipeline through their land and water supply. The crude oil pipeline is being built through sacred lands, burial grounds, and medicine harvesting sites, and is a continuation of the abuse of human rights, treaties, and nature. The Cannonball River is a tributary of the Missouri River, the longest river in North America, and the pipeline has already been laid close to the shores of Lake Aho, a dammed off section of the Missouri River, which is the water supply for the Standing Rock Sioux, as well as for millions of other people. I'm going to repeat that last part just to emphasize how crucial, you know, this water supply is. A section of the Missouri River, which is the water supply for the Standing Rock Sioux, as well as for millions of other people. Millions of people downstream from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Reservation rely on this water source that is being threatened by this pipeline. Millions of people have their drinking water threatened by the construction of the DAPL pipeline. That means that if this pipeline were to bust or break or leak, that millions of people would have a contaminated and poisoned water source full of toxins that give you cancer and induce mental illness and other forms of chronic diseases. Millions of people. Can you conceptualize that? How is that even a question of which one is more important than the other? Millions of people. Just to make that clear. The Dakota Access Pipeline would carry 440,000 gallons of fracked crude oil a day through the pipeline from the Bakken Formation, which reaches through parts of Montana, North Dakota, and Canada. The pipeline was supposed to pass the Missouri River just to the north of Bismarck, but due to concerns about potential oil leaks polluting the drinking waters of the state capital — what they actually mean by polluting the drinking waters of the state capital is polluting the drinking waters of wealthy, white, middle-class people who successfully got the pipeline rerouted through a tribal reservation. So brown people have their, you know, potential for water contamination rather than these white people who live in the state capital. Even though, just to be clear one more time, millions of people rely on this drinking this water source who are downstream, which includes all different types of people. So it's not just about one specific group of people, you know, in the end. All right. The pipeline was supposed to pass through Missouri River just to the north of Bismarck, but due to concerns about potential oil leaks polluting the drinking waters of the state capital, it was rerouted south through the land delineated to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in this 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie, thus putting the risk directly on the tribe's immediate and only water supply, as well as the water for the millions of people downstream. My heart and prayers are with the Standing Rock and the water protectors who are calling for a halt to the Dakota Access Pipeline, which not only threatens their water, but it runs through land that was illegally taken from them. Through these challenging times, it is easy to wallow in feeling helpless, angry, upset, and appalled at the abusive treatment of the indigenous people and water protectors by militarized forces protecting corporate fossil fuel interests that is aggressively using violent tactics against women, elders, medics, youth, and horses. This is what indigenous people have been dealing with for hundreds of years. And this monumental gathering of indigenous people from over 300 tribes coming together in prayer and unity is an incredible demonstration of resilience, connection, and the power of people to stand up for what is right. It's people who are gathered together in prayer and unity and coming together for the first time really in history. This is a historic moment for tribal nations to come together like this. We've got people who are historic enemies camping alongside each other, learning to live together and be together in this space. Private security uses dogs and mace on Native American women and children, protecting sacred sites being destroyed right in front of them, while North Dakota police are watching. People are out exercising their First Amendment rights and being met with militarized response in incredibly dangerous situations. Guns drawn, mace, planes flying overhead. We hope grassroots media gets the real message out and that we're gathered here in unity and prayer to stop this from happening. And that is Tara Huska, who is the National Program Director for Honor the Earth. And just to emphasize on the conditions that the Standing Rock Sioux and supporters are dealing with at the encampment, includes planes flying overhead at night without their lights off, very low to the ground, and very, very bright, blindingly bright spotlights being shined on the camp. The sound of construction nonstop, drones flying overhead. There's so many different tactics that the National Guard and the local police department and the security company, the private security company that DAPL contracted, using all of these tactics to prevent people from sleeping at night and trying to make people go insane and turn against each other. And so that is what people are dealing with on the ground right now and have been dealing with for the last several months.
Okay, well, I think you have a sense of Standing Rock. Thank you very much for that, Cindy. The research there you shared with us on the pipeline accidents, or what do they call them? When the pipelines bust, spills, the oil spills. Just for our listeners' benefit, I guess when you lived as long as I have, you do a little bit of everything. I've worked on some oil spills right here in the Bay Area. Nasty, ugly work. I hated it. My goodness. But I mean, I can see, you know, when you're waist high in the water with that oil floating on the top of it, and trying to corral it, and oh man, what a mess. Just 200 this year alone, over 200. Okay, right now I just want to bring to your attention, we do have Election Day coming up. We're going to be intermittently bringing up all kinds of different measures and things that could or should be voted on. And we're going to, I want to start off though with this, because this is something that I thought we shouldn't let go. Well, all right, I'm gonna bring this up because Cynthia's been talking about these police and how they were treating, you know, the people in Standing Rock. Well, guess what, man? In Southern California, the Service Employee International Union organizes police into their union. And these SEIU caucuses call on the AFL-CIO to kick out the police union. Now, the sad fact is that the SEIU is not, right at this moment, a part of the AFL-CIO due to an earlier split a few years back. But the organizers hope it will spark a wider discussion about the role of police and their so-called unions. On July of 2015, the University of California Student Worker Union, that is, these are students that are grad students that teach most of the classes. The grad students teach most of the classes, not the professors. And they're organized by the United Auto Workers 2865. They passed a resolution calling on the AFL-CIO to terminate the membership of the International Union of Police Associations, IUPA. Now, after a series of meetings in Los Angeles throughout October, the same resolution is making its way through the Service Employees International Union itself, Local 721, a local representing public service and nonprofit employees in Southern California. Although SEIU, as I said, was not a part of the AFL-CIO, they're hoping that that this discussion will enlighten people on the role that these phony ass police unions actually play. Now, you know, the first thing we have to say about this is the most obvious, and that is that cops are not workers. That's the main, that's the thing that sticks out to me. What a union is, an organization for the defense of the working class. That's what it is. A union is called into existence by the workers so that they can collectively bargain against the bosses. Police attack unions when they go on strike. Police attack workers. Police are an instrument of the 1% of the capitalists. And that's why it's kind of silly to be talking about the police as your union brother. No, police are not workers, and police unions are not unions. So it looks like this local 2865 of the UAW has done a good thing by bringing this up. And now SEIU is having a discussion about it. I'm hoping, you know, that the AFL-CIO will feel the fire from their members. We're in a country where the workers have not been going on strike a lot lately, and the unions have shrunk from 50% of the workforce in the night after World War II to 35% in the 70s, and then after Ronald Reagan came in there and started attacking the unions with his frontal assault of the aircraft of the Air Traffickers Union, the actual membership of people in unions in the workforce has gone down to 11%. So this is not the finest moment for American labor. But understanding who you are makes it far more possible that you can put up a fight. Yes, kick the goddamn cops out of all labor federations. All right, now, there's also another issue. Now we're going to talk about, you know, this thing about this white nationalism is becoming rather annoying, but it's also very dangerous. People know about the mobilization, hopefully, know about the mobilization that took place June the 26th this year, when over 500 militant youth basically smashed a Nazi gathering organized by the group calling itself the Traditionalist Workers' Party. That was not without some casualties. A number of our folks were stabbed in the process. But overall, we ran them out of town. Ran them out! And that was a good thing. Now, Mr. Donald Trump has put some air underneath the wings of these Nazis and fascists and KKK types, so that now the KKK's official newspaper just announced its support publicly for Mr. Donald Trump. Another white nationalist notch in Trump's belt. And, you know, we have to pay attention to this. The official newspaper of the Ku Klux Klan voiced its support for Donald Trump, adding to the already lengthy list of white nationalist groups who have cheered the Republican presidential nominee. The KKK Quarterly, The Crusader, which calls itself the premier voice of the white resistance, devoted its latest front page to a defense of Trump's Make America Great Again slogan. And I quote, "You can see it on the shirts, buttons, posters, and ball caps, such as the one being worn by Trump speaking at this rally." Okay? Writes Pastor Thomas Robb, the head of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. But can it happen? Can America really be great again? This is what we will soon find out, unquote. So, wow.
No, because America was never great.
Well, thank you, Senti. While Trump wants to make America great again, we have to ask ourselves, says this paper, what made America great in the first place? Rob continues. The short answer is simple. America was great not because of what our forefathers did, but because of who our forefathers were. America was founded as a white Christian republic, and as a white Christian republic, it became great. These are the words of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, I happen to agree with Senti. Actually, America was founded on the basis of slavery, the brutalities of slavery, and the genocide of Native Americans, the land grab of all their homeland. Senti, you have some more that you were going to tell us about these white nationalists right now.
You mentioned the Traditionalist Workers' Party and the mobilization in Sacramento. And that, just to be clear, wasn't just the Traditionalist Workers' Party. That was also the Golden State Skinheads and other rogue neo-Nazi skinhead gangs that joined the call. And in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the KKK joined forces with members of the National Socialist Movement and the Traditionalist Workers' Party to hold a rally at the state capitol in Pennsylvania on November 5th. So that was yesterday. And there's a report back on that I'm going to read, because white nationalism is a growing tendency, and Trump has been a rejuvenating voice for the white nationalist movement. It's definitely a real threat that needs to be taken seriously. It's not going to go away by ignoring it. And that's why it needs to be confronted head on, because a lot of these alt-right people are mainly an online social presence who network with each other through these different social forums and use coded language to articulate bigotry, so that can't be like outed and exposed easily. But these people are highly organized and are serious about what they believe in, which includes extermination of other groups of people and like continuing to like subjugate and dominate other groups of people by peddling this narrative of white victimization. And I think that it's really important to, you know, kind of hit the nail on the head with these like core beliefs that are driving this movement.
And when they come out their little hole, I think it's very important to send them scurrying and acquaint them with the pavement and let them know that there's a consequence for coming out in public with their genocidal program, putting it forward in front of the world. They will be humiliated every time they come out that hole.
Anti-fascists and Black Bloc clashed with neo-Nazis at the state capitol in Pennsylvania yesterday, and the neo-Nazis in question are the National Socialist Movement, Traditionalist Workers' Party, and the Ku Klux Klan, who all came together to participate in a joint rally under the banner of the Nationalist Front, formerly known as the Aryan Nationalist Alliance, a coming together of neo-Nazis and KKK organizations. This is only the latest attempt by the far right to hold a large rally in the United States that has been met by swift and militant anti-fascist resistance and organizing. Over 200 anti-fascist militants answered the call to shut down the fascist rally, while the neo-Nazis were only able to muster about 30 to 35 people. Despite attempts by local community leaders, the Democratic Party, and nonprofits to contain people's anger and divert counter-protesters away from the Capitol by holding a unity event, many arrived ready to physically engage the white supremacists and defend their communities. Due to the sheer size and militancy of the crowd, the Nazis were completely drowned out and could not be heard by anyone. The white supremacists had to be protected from the angry crowd by a wall of riot police, which far outnumbered the fascists. So it was a very similar situation as the last time the Traditionalist Workers' Party made an attempt to hold a rally at the state capitol grounds, where there was a swift and bold confrontation, and the Traditionalist Workers' Party was outnumbered by like, you know, 50-1 basically. And yeah, so hopefully they learn their lesson that is what is going to continue to happen if they show their faces in public. And the people that does not fall within the boundary of like, okay, these people and what they're saying is legitimate because it's free speech. It's like social violence disguised as free speech that should not be tolerated. That should not be tolerated when your speech targets another group of people with violence. In my opinion, that is no longer free speech. On the subject of white nationalism, white nationalists plot Election Day show of force. The KKK, neo-Nazis, and militias plan to monitor urban polling places and suppress the black vote. Neo-Nazi leader Andrew Anglin plans to muster thousands of poll watchers across all 50 states. His partners at the alt-right website The Right Stuff are touting plans to set up hidden cameras at polling places in Philadelphia and hand out liquor and marijuana in the city's ghetto on Election Day to induce residents to stay at home. The National Socialist Movement, various factions of the Ku Klux Klan, and the white nationalist American Freedom Party are all deploying members to watch polls either formally or, they say, through the Trump campaign. The Oath Keepers, a group of former law enforcement and military members that often shows up in public heavily armed, is advising members to go undercover and conduct intelligence gathering at polling places. And Donald Trump ally Roger Stone is organizing his own exit polling, aiming to monitor thousands of precincts across the country. Energized by Trump's candidacy and alarmed by his warnings of a rigged election, white nationalist alt-right and militia movement groups are planning to come out in full force on Tuesday, creating the potential for conflict at the close of an already turbulent campaign season. The possibility of violence on or around Election Day is very real, said Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Donald Trump has been telling his supporters for weeks and weeks and weeks now that they are about to have the election stolen from them by evil forces on behalf of the elites. It is difficult to know at what scale these plans will materialize because Anglin and his fringe right ilk are serial exaggerators, according to Potok. And rather than successfully uncover widespread voter fraud, for which there is a lack of compelling evidence, or successfully suppress minority turnout, Potok says the efforts are most likely to backfire. If on the morning of Election Day it turns out that we have white supremacists standing around looking threatening at polling places, I think it would arouse anger, he said. People would vote just to prove they're not being intimidated by these radical racists. Despite Trump's claim that American democracy is comprised by massive voter fraud, so far in this election, only one person, a Trump supporter in Iowa who attempted to vote twice, has been arrested for it. That has not stopped fringe groups already inclined to believe that minorities are stealing the election from heeding Trump's call to monitor voting in certain areas. In an email, the editor of the neo-Nazi Daily Stormer website said he had already led a big voter registration drive and that he was sending an army of alt-right nationalists to watch the polls. He said he was working in conjunction with the alt-right website, therightstuff.biz. A representative of that site wrote in an email, "We are organizing poll watchers in urban areas to cut down on the most traditional type of voter fraud. We also have stationary cameras hidden at polling locations in Philadelphia to monitor anyone that comes in to vote and make sure that the same people are not voting at multiple locations. If we see people voting at multiple locations, the footage will be submitted to the Federal Election Commission, as well as put out on social media to undermine the legitimacy of Hillary Clinton should she steal the election." The representative, who did not provide his name, went on to explain, "Many polling locations are in schools, and black schools are so disorderly that pretty much any official-looking white person with a clipboard can gain access to them ahead of time and set up a hidden camera. You don't really ever even have to speak with an adult. Simply walk in like you belong there, and no one even asks you why you were there. So we usually go in teams of two, one person driving and one person dressed as a blue-collar worker with a clipboard, and we set up a hidden camera in the school cafeteria. Go during lunchtime, and the teachers are all so busy trying to contain the kids that no one says anything. We already have a few set up. Following the initial publication of this article, the right stuff reversed itself and said it was not engaged in planting cameras or distributing drugs and liquor, and that it had fabricated those plans. The Trump campaign did not respond to a request for comment. A senior Trump advisor told Bloomberg Businessweek last month that the campaign is working on a three-pronged voter suppression strategy that includes an effort to depress black turnout. Though other Trump advisors later pushed back on the report, Anglin's partners say they are hoping to put Trump over the top by doing just that. We also have some teams going into the ghettos in Philly with 40s and weed to give out to the local residents, which we will think will lead to more of them staying home. We have had success with this in the past, wrote the representative of the right stuff, who said four teams of two employed this tactic in Detroit during the Democratic primary in an effort to help Bernie Sanders. 40s are 40-ounce bottles of malt liquor. Politico could not independently verify this claim. It remains an open question whether the neo-Nazis' plans materialize and to what extent. Mark Pitcavage, who monitors extremists for the Anti-Defamation League, said England lacks a track record of organizing real-world action and that he was skeptical he could get even close to what he was promising. More concrete, said Pitcavage, are the plans of the Oath Keepers, a militia movement group formed in 2009. It has thousands of active members, drawn largely from the ranks of former military, law enforcement, intelligence, and first responders, and a track record of mustering heavily armed members in public places. The group just issued a statement last month claiming that James O'Keefe's latest Project Veritas video provided evidence of a well-orchestrated campaign of criminal vote fraud on an industrial scale, and urging members to form up incognito intelligence gathering and crime spotting teams and go out into public on election day dressed to blend in with the public. The group said it believed most vote rigging was leftist, but that it would seek to expose fraud committed by anyone. Last week, the Washington Post reported that the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law would ask the Justice Department to investigate the group's election day plans. Stone, who first began advising Trump in the 80s and describes the alt-right as the new mainstream, has also come under scrutiny for his election day plans. The Republican operative, less concerned with fraud committed by voters than with vote rigging by elections officials, is organizing a volunteer exit polling operation that he hopes will reach 7,000 precincts that he sees as prone to rigging because of the voting methods employed and their one-party control. Stone said the precincts targeted include 2,000 in Philadelphia, as well as some Republican-controlled areas in Ohio, though he declined to specify where. If I told you, I would be watching the Republican Governor John Kasich machine, he said. Stone said he planned to present his findings to Trump and that he would consider any deviation of more than 2% between his exit polls and the posted precinct totals to be suspicious, citing the State Department's standard for monitoring foreign elections. But it is doubtful that a hastily assembled volunteer effort could result in reliable exit polling data, and Paddock warned anything he would produce would merely create more conflict and not lead us any closer to the truth of what happens out there. Other groups are combining poll watching with more traditional forms of politricking, including leafleting rallies and get out the vote efforts. Jeff Shoup, leader of the National Socialist Movement, said he was organizing a Saturday rally at the Pennsylvania State House in Harrisburg, where he expected between 75 and a few hundred people to show up to mobilize supporters ahead of the election. Shoup said the party, which has not officially endorsed Trump, though its members overwhelmingly support him, would deploy informal poll watchers through its roughly 50 chapters across the country. William Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party and an advocate of deporting non-whites from the United States, said his party's members are working through Trump's operation rather than organizing their own efforts. We have some of our members that are doing poll watching, but they're not doing it as American Freedom Party members, he said. They're doing it through the Trump campaign. We have a lot of people that are involved with the Get Out the Vote through the various Trump organizations, said the Los Angeles-based Johnson, who added that the party's California members are focused on aiding the Trump campaign in Nevada. Members of the party were also working with an Ohio car dealer to throw an Election Day party in Las Vegas at a rooftop location overlooking Trump International Hotel, but could not pull together the financing for it. According to Johnson, a lawyer who made headlines this week by commissioning robocalls in Utah that attack independent presidential candidate Evan McClellan as a closet homosexual. Meanwhile, members of the White Nationalist Traditionalist Workers Party will descend on Ohio to hand out leaflets hailing Trump as the peace candidate, according to the party's leader, Matthew Heimbach. Though a pale shadow of its former self, the KKK is also mobilizing for Election Day. Thomas Robb, national director of the Knights of Ku Klux Klan, which considers itself the national standard bearer of the KKK, said party members across the country would be working to get voters to the polls for Trump. And Louisiana Senate candidate David Duke, a former KKK Grand Wizard who supports Trump but was disavowed by the New York businessman in February after some hesitation in a CNN interview, said he supports plan to monitor polls with an eye toward some of the more inner city areas that he said exhibited suspicious voting patterns in the state's 1991 governor's race. But Duke said his supporters would not limit their efforts to black neighborhoods. It's good to watch everyone because there always can be major mistakes, Duke said, or unintentional mistakes. Who knows?
Well, you know what? I wanted to bring this up because many of the people who self-righteously call themselves the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Ain't that what they call themselves, Cynthia, sometimes? Well, Christianity has earned itself a pretty bad name through its association or, you know, the connection between the so-called white nationalists with Christianity. But here is a fact about Christianity that I think that most people may not be aware of. And that is less than half of practicing Christians read their Bible. And the rest of America is even worse. Despite its inevitable record as the most printed and sold book in the world, over the last five decades, less than half of practicing Christians in the United States spend serious time engaging with their Bible, according to the American Bible Society. And the rest of the country, well, they never even look at the thing. In a presentation at the Movement Day Global Cities Conference at the Jacob Javits Center last Wednesday, Samuel Harrell, director of Project Ignition at the American Bible Society, presented evidence gathered from a six-year assessment of the state of the Bible conducted by the Barna Group, which shows that just 18% of the American population, 18 years and older, in general, reads the Bible. Of the practicing Christians in the group, only 37% engage with their Bible. Now, this is a quote. We have been having the honor of walking for a number of years with the Barna Group and studying the state of the Bible in America. I know that you and I are feeling the change in the winds and the trends that are affecting us. So you probably had conversations about just what feels very real about the Bible in our culture, Mr. Harrell said. In Eat This Book, Eugene Peterson describes scripture, sorry about that, engagement as a relationship or a relational process. Quote, "What I mean to insist upon is that spiritual writing, spiritual sourced writing, requires spiritual reading, a reading that honors words as holy, words as a basic means of forming an intricate web of relationships between God and the human, between all things visible and invisible," he writes. In his book, The Fire of the Word, Chris Webb agrees. When we open the Bible, it does not say to us, "Listen, God is there." Instead, the voice of the Spirit whispers through each line, "Look, I am here," Webb explains. Fergus McDonald's of the Taylor University Center for Scripture Engagement told Bible Gateway, and I quote, "It is the Holy Spirit who enables the text to speak for itself. When the text speaks, it is the voice of God, the Father, that is heard. And it is Jesus Christ who, through the text, makes a unique claim upon the readers and hearers." According to Harold, the state of the study of the last 6 years of the Bible also showed that only 38% of Americans considered themselves friendly towards the Bible. Among those who said they read the Bible, 14% are men, 22% are women. Broken down by age, millennials are the least engaged with the Bible, representing just 12% of the Bible readers, while older adults, the largest age group, clocked in at 26%. When it comes to Bible engagement by race, African Americans lead the pack at 29%, followed by whites at 17%, and Hispanics account for 15%. Okay, we got work to do, baby. Among the 38% of Americans who consider themselves friendly to the Bible, both men and women expressed an almost equal amount of friendliness at 37 and 39%, respectively. Among the Bible-friendly group of Americans, 38% identified as millennials, 46% as black, 46% as Hispanic, while 36% identified as white. A whopping 62% of Americans said, however, that they want to read the Bible more. Oh, yeah, that guilt. That guilt keeps working on them. According to Harold, but there are challenges to this, particularly when it comes to millennials. Millennials, they are reading you and me. Millennials are looking at us. Millennials are saying, hey, 1/4 of millennials are skeptics. There are those who are indicating that not only do they not believe the Bible, but they characterize the Bible as just another book or fairy tale. But they also voiced opposition to the Bible and consider it a dangerous book, Harold said.
Oh, yeah.
Despite the challenges, said Harold, millennials are likely to engage more with the Bible when they see the sacred book's impact on the lives of others. As one of our experts at ABS said, the number one reason millennials give for increasing their Bible reading is its impact on someone else. Think about that, said Harold. What are they saying? We've got to get to them, he says, you know. Well, the reason you're losing them is because you need to lose them. Let's move away from fairy tales and myths and develop an understanding and analysis of reality. an appreciation of history and forge our characters to prepare for the struggle for workers' power.
You are listening to Black, Berkeley Liberation Radio. All right. Last week we talked about the acquittal of the Bundy gang, and there have been more developments since then.
You got to look out now, because this goddamn Senti is hardcore. When he be coming at you, he come at you hard. Oh, man. Go ahead, Senti. I'm sorry.
The Bundy clan is now calling for revolution. Okay, so there is a statement that Bundy released, and let me pull that up for just a moment. I don't know if you want to just like give people an idea like about the Bundy, what happened with the acquittal.
Yeah, you know, this Bundy stuff, we talked about it last week, babe, remember?
We did, yeah.
Okay, we were talking about this armed militia occupied some federal land. And eventually, the majority of them, by the way, people should know, the majority of them basically accepted the guilty plea and went to prison. But the judge actually let at least one of the Bundys and someone out, they let them go. And people were shocked. Because clearly they had violated the law. And this was something that was not expected. But except, here's those of us who study these Nazi and fascist organizations and these proto-Nazi organizations. These militias have the potential, very real potential, just like some of these alt-rights that are not yet real hard Nazis. They have the potential of developing into that. And it looks like basically the 1% doesn't want to discard their future help because they feel they may need these Bundy types one day. Having said that.
And so Bundy from a telephone in an Oregon jail 2 weeks ago, said, read the Declaration of Independence when he was being interviewed. It says right there that if the government becomes abusive, it is our right and our duty to abolish that government. If the government won't restrain itself, whatever happens is their own fault. And he made suggestions of a potential uprising, which underscores the extent to which the two competing political movements, defiance of federal authority and Obama's determination to permanently protect vast federal lands, could collide next in this arid patch of land 110 miles northeast of Las Vegas, talking about the land related to the 2014 armed standoff with Bundy. And for many generations, ranchers in Bunkerville have paid a fee to graze their cattle on the Gold Butte land, but nearly all of them allowed the Nature Conservancy and other groups to buy out their permits years ago. The Bundy family, which has fewer than 600 head of cattle, is the last full-time ranching family in the area. Their animals still graze for free, as they have for years, in defiance of federal courts twice ordering the Bundys to desist. The family has refused to pay more than $1 million in fees and fines related to cattle grazing.
Look, I want to say this, though. I don't really understand this question of cattle eating grass off outside of the property of their owners, who then tell, I guess, take the cattle and sell them, right? And they sell them on the market. I don't know much about this, but I tend to think that $1 million is a lot of money for some grass. I really don't know what's going on here. So I'm not, you know, ready to condemn the Bundys for being antisocial in their fight against paying this particular fee. But regardless, let's look at what actually happened.
Yeah, and just to respond to that directly, Gerald, I can speak to that from my personal experience in Eastern Oregon. This last summer, I spent around 1 month in the Malheur National Forest, which is right outside of the town of Burns. And Burns is where the Bundy gang would hold their marches and their rallies in town and
you
do outreach.
Saw this?
I did not. That was at a different time when that was going on. But what I'm telling you is that I spent time in the national forests, like the Malheur, where the occupation was, where the Bundy occupation was. That federal building was the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, right? So that was for the Malheur National Forest. And there are a lot of cattle grazing allotments in the Malheur. And the reason it's bad for cattle ranchers to have free reign with public lands is because cattle are non-native. The cattle are an invasive species to these lands. And so when you introduce herds of cattle into an area like a national forest, it is a form of neocolonialism because you're completely transforming the landscape irreversibly. The cattle shit everywhere. They contaminate streams. They trample stream banks. They incise the stream banks. They trample native plants. They eat the plants. They erode and compact the soil. The list goes on and on and on. They eat saplings of rare tree species like alder trees. And so as a whole, in terms of ecology, cattle are very destructive to public lands. And, cattle is being ranched, cattle ranching for the purpose of, butchering them at some point, right? You know, and so they can be consumed. And so it opens up larger questions, and that's why it is important for there to be fines and limits instated on cattle ranchers, or else public lands like national forests, what little there is left remaining, especially a good example of that too is in when the Bundy gang was occupying the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, which is in Burns. The Bundy gang dug up indigenous burial sites and turned them into latrines and shit in them, you know? So that's a perfect example too of why that, is there needs to be limits and regulations imposed. Exactly. And because otherwise if, they got their way, it would just be completely devastated and exploited, which is already what's happened. You know, there's less than 2% of native old growth remaining in Oregon, and that was in Oregon in particular. They would chop everything down and turn it all into grazing allotments. That's why it's important. But
thank you, brother. That's why, I really value this young brother, the others that come through here and work on the station, because none of us is as smart as all of us. We all have to, we learn from each other also, and I honestly didn't know, and now that you've mentioned it in such detail, I understand much more clearly what was going on. Thank you.
And There were a lot of people in Burns who were not supportive of the Bundy gang whatsoever, and you know, did not welcome them in town and did not want them around, did not feel okay with, you know, the occupation of the wildlife refuge. But getting back to Bundy's statement, he said that the government should be scared. They are in the wrong. The land does not belong to the government. The land belongs to the people of Clark County, not to the people of the United States, said Bundy, who spoke over the phone as his wife Angie sat nearby beneath a shady tree in the family's 160-acre ranch on the parched banks of the Virgin River. The only peaceful resolution to all of this is for them to obey the Constitution, he said. Read it, understand it, abide it. There doesn't have to be violence. None of that has to happen if they would just abide by the Constitution. And he said that the establishment of any new monument in the state of Nevada, regardless of location, ought to be considered in the public congressional process. Just going on about all this shit, but at the core of what he was saying, as far as the core source of conflictuality, is, you know, ownership of the land and who the land belongs to. And when the occupation was going on at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, the local tribe, the Burns Paiute, made it very clear they didn't want the Bundy gang around. And if you're going to talk about ownership of land and who the land belongs to, it's definitely the local First Nations people. It's the first people of that land. And so it's very ignorant and arrogant for Bundy to be claiming that the land belongs to, you know, his people within a given county, any of that land, regardless of the jurisdiction or the restrictions on that land. And that is all that I have to say about that.
Okay, well, I thank you, you know. And I wanted to report the Black Panther Party 50th year commemoration activities, believe it or not, are still going on this Saturday. That is yesterday. Thank you for straightening me out before. I attended a forum which was called Party Music. He is both a DJ for KPFA. Ricky Benson, his name is, the son of Theodore Benson, who's written several excellent books on Black history and the Garvey movement, was heading up a forum on the history of a group called the Lumpins, but not just, which was a group of Black Panthers that did music, you know, about the Black struggle. And of course, Professor Vincent went beyond simply the Lumpins, but in the course of this forum, they had one of the original Lumpins present. That was the name of the group, was the Lumpins. And he gave his experience. He shared his experience. And kind of interesting. I thought it was very interesting. But what I wanted to do was to share with you the the song that they played. No, they didn't play this song. I heard this song by the Lumpins played at the 50th anniversary. And I asked the brother right on the spot, I said, man, where you get that song? And he explained to me where I could get the song from. So I've got it here for you, and I'm going to play it for you. Just show you. I always liked it. I remember it as Bobby Must Be Set Free. If you recall, Bobby Seale was arrested. He became, in the trial of the Chicago 7, Bobby Seale was framed up and brought into that trial and became the 8th defendant after the Chicago riots. Actually, in fact, the Black Panther Party did not support riots. Our experience had taught us that riots by themselves are not an answer. So actually, the Panthers didn't support rioting as a political method. But Bobby Seale was wrongfully brought into the trial. And if those of you who have a knowledge of history or memory of history, you remember Bobby Seale's lawyer was not present, and he wanted his lawyer to be present. He wanted to defend himself in court until his lawyer could show up. The judge in Chicago would not permit this, and Bobby Seale kept chanting and demanding that he have his constitutional rights, which led to the response of the court in Chicago and his judge in Chicago. They tied Bobby Seale up and put tape around his mouth and brought him into the courtroom in that fashion. Didn't stop Bobby Seale from resisting. You could hear him saying, "Hit me off." But anyway, here is that song. Okay, there you have it. Bobby must be set free. Free all class war prisoners. Yes, sir. And I just thought that would be a nice little addition. Let's always maintain a sense of history when we talk about, you know, our struggle, because the struggle for human liberation and for Black liberation didn't just start yesterday afternoon. It's been around, and we want to stay cognizant of that history as best we can. Give us a little South African song right now, and we'll be right back at you.
Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela, beautiful song by a South African choir, the African National Congress Choir. Nelson Mandela brings us peace. A mandla, a revolution in four-part harmony. Okay, now we are going to deal with this upcoming election a little bit. Particularly, we're interested in these propositions on the California ballot. There are 17 of them. Some of these are significant. For instance, Proposition 62, which would abolish the unfair and often racist death penalty in California, while Proposition 64 would speed up. No, I think it's Proposition 66 would speed up the executions. All right. Well, let me be careful now, because Proposition 61 will place price controls on prescription drugs. That would be a good thing if it could happen. Neither Democrat nor Republican parties back it. And the pharmaceutical industry has outspent its backers 7-1 to defeat Proposition 61. Yet it is still winning in the polls. So that looks like that's the one for us, all right? So we're going to share our opinion on these various propositions with you. We're going to start off, we got to be very specific. because we excuse me. We're headed safely back to shore here. And there's so many of them. My goodness. Okay. So Proposition 51, public and private school bond. We want to tell people to vote no. No. What is a bond? Well, a bond is when they borrow money from private banks. So in this case, it would be a $9 billion school bond. Of that $9 billion, $1 billion of our tax dollars will go towards funding the construction of private schools, private charter schools. This is a school privatization with public funds. Think about that. School privatization contributes to the deterioration of our public educational system and the erosion of the separation of church and state. In addition, bonds are an expensive way to raise money, profiting wealthy investors at taxpayer expense. These bonds will be paid back over a 30-year period and will cost taxpayers an additional $8.6 billion. That is $8.6 billion in tax-free profit for the capitalist class at our expense. That's the California Democratic Party. Let me tell you, no to school privatization, no on Proposition 51. Proposition 52, the Medi-Cal hospital tax, we are recommending that you vote yes. Okay, Proposition 52 is, you know, something we had to look to the health workers to help us out, because to tell you the truth, it's hard to figure all this stuff out by yourself. So the health workers and numerous other unions and advocacy groups have been backing this Proposition 52. Proposition 52 charges a fee to hospitals to fund Medi-Cal, which is our state's socialized healthcare insurance, like the national system called Medicare. So, while of course it's inadequate and it falls far short, please vote yes. I get that. Yes. On Proposition 52. Proposition 53 is the undemocratic restrictions on the use of revenue bonds. Vote no on 53. Now here again, this is finance. Let me see if I can explain this to you a little bit. You know, the California Labor Federation, that is AFL-CIO, California League of Conservation Voters, California NACP, and the Peace and Freedom Party and the Green Party all are opposing Proposition 53. Like the dreaded Proposition 13 that passed years ago, Proposition 53 requires an undemocratic supermajority vote. In this case, the supermajority is required for the government to use revenue bonds to fund any project that exceeds a cost of $2 billion. So this would be used as an excuse to not improve our schools, highways, etc. They could just say, oh, sorry, can't get the supermajority of the state legislature, so we can't, fix that hole in the roof of your school. This is nuts. So we want to discourage that. We got Proposition 54, so that's vote no on 53. Proposition 54, legislative sunshine constitutional amendment and statute. We want you to vote yes on that, because Proposition 54 requires the state legislature to post the complete text of any bill they are proposing online at least 72 hours in advance of the vote. Think about that a minute. That's common sense. No, I'm not supporting any politicians here. This is a question of our right to know. Okay? We want that. Always defend the people's right to know. Proposition 55 is the tax on the wealthy to fund health care and education. Yes, clearly. Let's, if you're going to get a chance to vote on something, vote on that, please. Vote yes on Proposition 55. Proposition 55 continues the income taxes of Proposition 30, which passed in 2012, which is set up to expire in 2018. It taxes people who make over $250,000 a year, making the rich pay for education and health care. In addition, this proposition drops the regressive half-cent sales tax of Proposition 30 that was used for the same purposes. Overall, it is an improved extension of Proposition 30 that will last until 2030. It will continue to raise an approximate $6 billion a year or more to fund education and health care. So that's a good thing. Yes, vote yes on Proposition 55. Proposition 56 deals with massive increase in the regressive tax on tobacco. So they're going to tax the hell out of cigarettes, and that'll show them. Vote no on that bullshit. Now look, y'all. Cigarette smokers are not the enemies of humanity. They may be their own worst enemies, but they're not the enemies of humanity. Let's not allow the 1% to trick us once again into going after a false flag here. Vote no on Proposition 56. Okay. Proposition 57 is fewer trials for juveniles as adults and expedited parole for nonviolent offenders. I think you all agree. We all agree. Don't try children as adults. And if people have not committed a violent act, we want to let them out of prison. Yeah? Too many people in prison? Come on, y'all. Yes. Vote yes, please, on Proposition 57. I'm going to take a... All right. Senti's ready to share some information along another line. We're going to break it up a little bit. Here he goes.
A few things. One is that I wanted to announce an event that starts at 2 o'clock today and goes until 4, and this is last minute, but I'm still going to put the word out. There is a West Berkeley Shell Mound Interfaith Prayer, and the address for that is 1900 4th Street in Berkeley, and the event description is calling all prayer warriors. The Ohlone sacred site is in danger of being destroyed. We are calling all friends and allies to come forward and put our hearts together with the intentions to save the oldest Ohlone site in the entire bay. While we are gathered together, we will also send our prayers to the warriors holding the front lines in North Dakota at Sacred Stone Camp, Red Warrior Camp, and other camps. We will send prayers for the waters everywhere in the world and the sacred sites that are in danger of being destroyed worldwide and the genocides taking place. We will send prayers out to the four directions. I'm calling on all of my spiritual friends to come forward at this time to assist us with this prayer to create healing. So once again, that is called by Ohlone tribal members and is at 1900 4th Street in Berkeley. and that goes until 4 o'clock today. One other thing that I wanted to announce is that a water protector, an indigenous water protector, has been charged with attempted murder. Her name is Red Fawn, and the description reads, "A Dakota Access Pipeline activist was charged Monday with attempting murder for allegedly firing 3 shots at deputies as they tried to remove protesters last week occupying private property in Morton County, North Dakota. Red Fawn, 37, was charged with attempted murder, preventing arrest, carrying a concealed weapon, marijuana possession, engaging in a riot, and criminal conspiracy to endanger by fire during the Thursday protest along State Highway 1806. The criminal complaint filed by the Morton County State's attorney said deputies were attempting to handcuff her as she lay face down on the ground when she pulled out a .38 revolver from underneath and began firing. Neither of the deputies was hit, but Ms. Fallis told them later, 'They are lucky she didn't shoot all of you,' according to the complaint. Her arrest came as the National Sheriff's Association joined North Dakota lawmakers in urging the Obama administration to send resources as violence escalates at the 11-week protest. Jonathan Thompson, NSA Executive Director and CEO, said in a letter to Attorney General Loretta Lynch that the occupation is long past the point of peaceful and respectful protest. He said the federal government has aided the protesters, who number from 1,500 to 2,500, by allowing them to camp on U.S. Army Corps of Engineer property. From our perspective, the federal government's inaction is tantamount to supporting and encouraging dangerous behavior by the same individuals committed to creating economic and community chaos. Law enforcement arrested 142 activists in connection with Thursday's face-off, which saw protesters burn vehicles, set fires on Highway 1806 and nearby bridge, throw Molotov cocktails, rock and debris at officers. So, once again, Miss Fallis, Red Fawn, is being charged with attempted murder, which carries a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison or a fine of $20,000. So she is in need of support. If you want to write her a letter, which you should, go to the Ghost Town Prisoner Support Facebook page, and her mailing address is on there. You go to Facebook and you search Ghost Town Prisoner Support, the page, and then you will find the Ghost Town Prisoner Support Facebook page. And Red Fawn, Fallis, is her contact information is listed on the Facebook page if you want to write her a letter. And this last Thursday, we hosted a letter writing event where we mailed her letters along with some of the prison strike leaders who are continuing to face retaliation, such as Kinetic Justice. And there was a statement released yesterday that he is still on hunger strike and he's in danger of his life. And he has been inside for over 22 years. He's a co-founder of the Free Alabama Movement. He's been working successfully organizing successfully work stoppages and to demand basic human rights, and has provided education and legal support to hundreds of incarcerated people. So there was a demonstration at Limestone yesterday where the Free Alabama Movement... Limestone is in Alabama. It is outside of prison. The Free Alabama Movement, the Ordinary People Society, and the Queen Team are asking that everyone come out, that was yesterday, to Limestone Correctional Facility to show support for Kinetic Justice. So that just happened. And then also the Free Alabama Movement is saying, call with demands today. Call the Alabama Department of Corrections and Alabama Governor Robert Bentley's office demanding, one, that Kinetic Justice be transferred from Limestone Correctional Facility, which is known as the Bully Unit, because of the egregious conditions, and two, that Pastor Kenneth Glasgow of the Ordinary People Society be allowed to visit Kinetic Justice and assess his condition immediately. So those two numbers real quick for you are the ADOC, Alabama Department of Corrections, 334-353-3883. Once again, that's 334-353-3883. That's the Alabama Department of Corrections. And Governor Robert Bentley, his number is 334-242-7100. Again, that's 334-242-7100. And once again, the demands are 1, that Kinetic Justice be transferred from Limestone Correctional Facility, and 2, that Pastor Kenneth Glasgow be allowed to visit him and assess his condition immediately.
Yeah, I did want to mention in association with this matter that Brother Kinetic thought that he might, the authorities might have been attempting to poison him. So he engaged on a hunger strike, and that was middle of October. So it's getting, you know, it's been a while. This man hasn't eaten, and also they turned the water off in his cell. Now wait a minute. So clearly, this is not something to be taken lightly. If you have the time or the desire, please make that call. Okay. Right now we're gonna return to these propositions, and we're at Proposition 58, which is about the restoral of bilingual education. I don't think I have to say it. Obviously, yes. There's some things we need to vote for, and this is one. Okay? No to the anti-immigrant chauvinism. Yes to giving immigrant kids better educational opportunities through bilingual programs. Please vote yes on Proposition 58. Proposition 59, overturned Citizens United. It doesn't really. It is purely advisory to show the collective attitude of Californians towards Citizens United. Nevertheless, we think it's a good idea that you vote yes on that particular. I mean, do people know that Citizens United is the Supreme Court decision that equated money with the freedom of speech? And thus, that is why we have the best Congress that money can buy today. Proposition 60, mandated condoms in pornography with citizen enforcement. I don't know what this is about. You want the condoms in the porn? Say what? No, man, look here. Stay in your lane. I believe that the people that engage in pornographic theater, whatever you want to call it, filmmaking, I think they know what they're doing. Believe me. So I'd say, nah, not this time, buddy. You ain't going to press my button to get me to acting a fool about something I don't need to be worrying about. Vote no. Proposition 61. Now, this is important. This is price controls placed on the pharmaceutical industry. I don't know how effective it will be, but yes, vote yes, yes. Proposition 61 limits what the pharmaceutical industry can charge for drugs. It does this by limiting the price state agencies are allowed to buy prescription drugs for. That limit will be set by the lowest price paid for that same drug by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Please vote yes on Proposition 61. Yes. Proposition 62, the abolition of the death penalty in California. We've talked about this already. I think you guys know our opinion. Vote yes, abolish the death penalty. Okay. Proposition 63, gun ammunition bans and reporting ammunition sales to the Department of Justice. Vote no. Vote no. No to gun control, especially crazy sick shit. Proposition 64, the legalization of marijuana. Legalize it, yeah, yeah. Don't you criticize it. Oh, man, you better vote yeah on that, fool. Vote yes on Proposition 64. Proposition 65 is the plastic bag company's attempt to confuse the voters. I think you should vote no. Proposition 66 is for expedited speeding up of executions. It is the opposite of 62. And that is something you want to vote no. Vote yes on 62. No on 66. Hell no. They got this disposable bag ban. Yeah, okay, maybe. It's not the most important in the world. So there you have it. Slave Revolt Radio has shared its proposition perspectives with you. I hope you enjoyed our broadcast today, and please tune in again next week, 12 o'clock, Slave Revolt Radio.
There's a new world coming, and it's just around the bend. There's a new world coming, this one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, you can hear it if you try, and it's growing stronger with every day that passes by. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a brand new morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawning that belongs to you and me. Yes, a new world's coming. You know the one I'm talking about, the one we've had visions of, and it's coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in love.
And I saw another sign in heaven, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I